Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey guys, welcome back to Soul Sisters. I'm Dara Golub.
I'm Jesse Katz.
Hello, and today we have an outstanding guest, Ute Lemper, who, you know, you might not be familiar with. She's an international singer, actress, cabaret performer. During the podcast, I referred to her as a sort of researcher historian.
Yes.
Because she really takes texts from writers, authors, poets, composers, and just reinterprets them to be her own one-woman show in a way. And they sort of run the gamut from all kinds, from Neruda's love stories, Charles Bukowski, Paul Coelho, and she really feels very connected to the fact of her German heritage. She's German, but she's lived here for about 30 years, and she grapples with her German heritage a lot and her work, and I think it's evolving. We get into all of that. She's done a lot of work surrounding Holocaust and a lot of the work of Kurt Vile she's dealt with. So it was a fascinating, very different discussion for us, I think.
Yeah. I loved it, though. It's very refreshing to talk about politics with a guest, but not have it just be about Trump, for example. Yeah. You know, to talk about global politics and history.
And the sweep of history in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And putting some things in perspective in doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fascinating. I reached out the second that her name appeared in my inbox, announcing that she is going to be performing at Cafe Carlyle soon. I immediately wrote back and said, we have to have her on the show. And then realized I wasn't sure I was that familiar with her work. I just knew that her name was a big international name.
Yeah.
You know, she's just been one of those. So it was great to dig into her work in advance of her coming in and then talk to her about it.
Right. She has a show at the Carlyle, one of our favorite places. To see music and to have a date night. So she'll be doing the music of Marlene Dietrich there and sort of a show surrounding a very intimate experience she had with her. It was very exciting to have her on the show.
Yeah. So here she is, Ute Lemper on Soul Sisters. Thank you for coming on the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is quite an honor for us. I thought I would kick things off by just talking about how I read the piece that the Times did on you last year where it was like spending Sunday with so-and-so. And I love those pieces. Yeah. I think they're so fascinating. But it was so funny to read about your day as if you're just an ordinary Upper West Side mom who's...
As if I am.
You are, but you also have had the most extraordinary life and career, you know. So you are extra fascinating to read about in that context.
What did they do? What did you do? And who are you? I missed that.
Oh, we just did the Museum of Natural History. Mm-hmm. I live right next door. We did Artie's, which closed. The restaurant Artie's, our favorite restaurant, and it's closed on Broadway, and we did a jam session at home. I think the kids were playing the piano and drums, and
I think you and your husband had a glass of wine.
Oh, not
somewhere.
A fight. That's good.
Maybe they didn't write that up. I don't know.
Probably afterwards.
No, but it's funny. Right. Yeah. So I love the idea that you have a very provincial New York life as well. This
yes,
very international
yeah.
life.
Very residential.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I feel the Upper West Side. It's like a little village. Everything's very close. My kids go to public school.
Yeah.
The playgrounds are closed.
Uh-huh.
And every afternoon activity, even the baseball center is underneath the bank. And then on the next block, you wouldn't know, you know, the life underneath the sub New York. I feel it's very close. You can walk everywhere to every supermarket and restaurant, and friends are close. So I feel I like the community. It's close and warm-hearted.
Yeah.
Very alive.
Right. I love the Upper West Side also because for as much as New York City changes constantly, I feel like that neighborhood feels a little untouched by time.
Yeah,
it's just
unfortunately.
Still classic New York.
Yeah. Right. Unfortunately, all the little stores, they are closing up. You know, the rents are shooting up. And the restaurants, my favorite Greek restaurant, are all gone. Yeah, gone to
so
Duane
sad.
Reed and Chase Bank
right.
and stuff.
Oh,
right.
The bank.
Yeah, it's a pity. It's a pity.
Yeah.
So you wonder how it will look in 50 years, you know?
Yeah.
Whether it's going to be all abstract monopoly of, you know, the big shops and
I mean,
stuff.
What's the alternative to that? But at the same time, I mean, how can it keep going at that pace?
Something might give. Who knows? Do you spend much time thinking about those kinds of things? Like what? What's
I do all the time. You know, I have four kids. The oldest is 23. The youngest is 6.
Yeah.
You wonder, how will this world look like in 50 years? I mean, with a digital explosion.
Right.
Will there be a different kind of personality that is like, in the new book of Dan Brown, I'm not such a fan, but I just look through the subjects because it's historically well researched and it's interesting visions in these books. His vision of the new kind of humanity and in the evolution of people is some kind of consciousness that is half digital and half human. Mm-hmm. And if you see the kids nowadays on their iPads and iPhones at the age of 6, and the way they think and see things with Minecraft, these games, and what will that do to people?
Yeah,
and the
right.
music, how music is so programmed and computerized nowadays.
Uh-huh.
How will this thing that we old people is our nature, how will that survive?
So I love talking about this. I'm so glad we're
I know, but
to
this is, oh my God, we have another thing to talk about, right?
We'll talk about all of it. But because I just had this debate with my college friends over email this week, and we were debating whether or not it's really any different than it's always been.
Yeah.
You know, like he quoted, I forget what, it was like Plato or Socrates, who was complaining about the younger generation in exactly the same way that we do now.
Right.
But it does feel different. Because the technology
it's
has
such a
taken
leap.
Such
it's
a
such
leap,
a different
right.
leap. But
it's a leap,
yes, and I wanted to ask you in that sort of same vein about sort of a darker side, kind of the political climate that we're living in now. That's a separate thing that we can get to. But you were quoted as saying something like, it's a mistake to think that we're living in darker times now than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a cycle, you know, history repeats itself. And just like every era has its own things that contribute to its feeling. So I'm curious if you feel that way about the digital, like the inventions.
Well, that's not necessarily dark. It's just progress, you know. I mean, and it's not a world war.
Right.
You know, this is something that will help in many, many areas of life, like medicine and technology.
But do you feel like now we're living in an age of progress that is different than the levels of progress that we've seen?
A different kind of progress, definitely. But not necessarily that the times are more cruel. You know, if you look at the cruelty and brutality of regimes and governments and wars, how bloody they were through the centuries, and still not even, I mean, World War II finished only in 45. If you imagine that, how cruel people shot each other in the most civilized countries into the head, you know, and killed the children and women and the heartlessness of nationalism and... Mm-hmm. Even patriotism, you know, that's a cool feeling too. I mean, why do you have to be a patriot? Why?
Right.
You know, why are you better than another nation and fight for that nation?
Side note, this is why I always say I don't care about the Olympics. Because
but
I
really,
don't root for
I mean,
my country in that
you,
way.
You rule for the greatest athlete, that's
right.
it, you know.
Right.
So I think, you know, nowadays, yes, we have regions that have not evolved and are backwards regressing with the religious wars and... you know, the migration, and it's just a horrifying thing to see from the North African countries. That is just, but we had genocide after the Holocaust. We still have this today. People butcher themselves for religious reasons, and they come from a different tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And we report about it. The media goes everywhere. We know about everything nowadays. But I would say, in general, that the cruelty has altered into a different kind of cruelty. The cruelty of knowing and not doing anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't know. Mm. People didn't know in the 50s exactly, even up to the Gulf War, mm-hmm. people really didn't know exactly how the wars were happening inside the trenches. Now we know, and we have the reporters, and now turning the head is a different kind of cruelty.
So should we take solace in the fact that nothing's really changed, or should we be hopeless?
No, neither nor, not right? Yet. I mean, that's that everyone has to do what they can do to stand up and fight and go onto the protest marches and speak up wherever you can.
Totally.
Why not speak up for and against anything you stand for?
Mm-hmm. Will you be at the Women's March this weekend? It's in your backyard, basically. Maybe you'll be hiding.
My daughter makes me do these things. She's a student in Philadelphia. She goes to all of these things.
Uh-huh.
I have to see, because on Sunday I'm leaving to Europe.
Oh, are you? Okay, yeah. You got to protect your health and your body.
Yeah, and the
first
screaming,
and
it doesn't do as good to the vocal cords.
Right, exactly.
Right?
I know. And it's hard to be in those crowds and not scream. Yeah, you get carried away with the fervor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, it's true. I mean, sometimes I think about, you know, the progress or lack of progress we made in this country over things like race, and it's like, well, slavery was basically yesterday, and
it was basically
the grand scheme
yesterday.
Of time, you mm-hmm. know. So, mm. we've come a long way if you yeah. consider that, or even
and,
Jim Crow.
And if you imagine how long and centuries we did not do anything about anything,
right,
you know,
right.
the Dark Ages, you know, when the church yeah. was like dictating knowledge and education, and women were not existing in,
uh-huh.
in these. How could that happen?
Yeah,
you know, that the church had such power over people and was allowed to collect the money and dictate the world out there in Europe.
Right. So I have a couple of follow-up
horrible.
Questions, which. They seem like Russian dolls to me. So the first one is, how do you approach issues that, like, for example, American politics today, as a German living in the United States who's raised children here? Do you is there some distance that you have on things like that, or you feel as affected and invested?
You know, when I'm New York, I feel I am a New Yorker.
Yeah.
But I don't quite feel like an American.
Okay, got it. Yeah,
I have the European thing in me and the heritage,
uh-huh.
and so I look sometimes and I roll my eyes and think these Americans.
Right,
you get
that luxury,
you know?
That little bit of a distance.
Yeah, yeah. But then again, you know, my kids have American passports, and of course we love this country,
mm-hmm.
and.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. It seems that you've had a journey and an evolution of your own feeling about Germany and your heritage there that might be shifting.
That's a complicated thing, too. I don't feel German.
Right.
I don't live in Germany for many, many, 35 years.
But now, is that feeling slightly shifting? Because of just sort of the perception of Germany now, with Angela Merkel is such a powerful leader. She's a wonderful model.
She's a good one, yeah.
And then she simultaneously has, the feeling that we have here is kind of a national shame now, you know?
Well, that's what they think out there, right?
Right.
Trump, I know, who's apparently from Germany, this little city down there.
Oh, right.
South Germany.
Is that the Drumpf? Part of his name?
Know.
You know, that was the original family name?
Yeah. It was a different spelling at the time, yeah. You know, it's complicated.
Yeah.
That's a personal thing that I feel derooted from everything. I don't feel German anymore. I haven't lived there. I feel a little bit German, a little bit French. I lived many years in Paris.
Uh-huh.
I definitely feel New Yorker-wise with the parts of American in me. And my kids give me the American culture every day, and I live it. But, you know, I feel kind of isolated from everything. On a good day, that is great.
Uh-huh.
And on a bad day, you can feel a little lonely.
Yeah.
But
is it good for the artist?
I guess it is. Because I also travel everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
My concerts are really literally
right.
everywhere.
Right.
South America, Australia, Asia, everywhere in Europe. And I bring something historical, unique, very personal, existential journey through music to the people, and people are receptive for it. But a certain kind of people, not the big audience, I would say. And I like that. I live in a niche, as they say, and that is true, also in a personal way. I think. And I don't like loud parties and a lot of people. And I like
cabaret. Well, that atmosphere of...
No, and I don't actually do cabaret anywhere else but in New York. You know, I really play the concert halls and the arts festivals, and whether they're jazz or theater or classical music festivals. And like last week, I played the Berlin Philharmonie, which is a most important, beautiful Philharmonie concert venue, like the Carnegie Hall of New York. And it was built in the 50s by Karajan, the conductor who put it there at the Potsdamer Platz, where the Russian sector was... separated from the American sector, and it was in the no man's land. It was the beginning of the Cold War, and he put it there as a symbol of freedom of art, and we put this right here to let you know and see we are continuing with our free freedom of expression and art. And then it was for 28 years that the wall was up. It was right next to the wall and was really a symbol. And now, since 89, it's down. It's in, surrounded by, of course, busy life and big city life, but that was very special, and I performed there for the first time in 1988, still a year before the fall of the wall. So that was in that isolated situation, and it was so nice to be back, you know, almost 25 years later with in a different Germany nowadays.
Was that having such a niche in your career? I was describing you to someone earlier this morning as being an artist who's a very big deal to a certain kind of person, right? All over the world, you know?
Yeah.
So your footprint is huge, but you do have a lane that you found and stuck to. But was that always intentional? Did you ever try to break out of that and it didn't feel right, or it didn't quite take, and then you came back?
Well, I mean, I would have liked maybe to step over in a more commercial territory here and there, like through the movies, for example, would be probably the most...
You mean as an actress?
Yeah, not with pop music. That wasn't really my ticket, even though I always loved R&B music. That's, you know, I was a teenager in the 70s. That was the great music, the great time for music.
I think that was in the New York Times piece that you guys put on R&B in the house.
Yeah, and, you know, the time, and then of also pop music at the time, Pink Floyd, and all of that was just great. But with the movies, maybe that could have been a possibility. But then also I got children, so there was a priority with, you know, not to go in too far with that. But yes, I feel it was a natural journey. It started with a very selective project by Decca Universal Music to re-record the music that was banned by the Nazis, Kurt Weill, Brecht, and then the Berlin Cabaret songs that really happened in the Weimar Republic. So that's a very researched kind of territory of music. And
was that your own just... will that you wanted to do that? Or
well,
was
I sang that. I was in the beginning of my 20s and I lived in Berlin. It was in the middle of the 80s. I researched Kurt Weill. I wrote my first recital, and I wrote This Evening myself with the pianist. We performed in a theater, and then Decca had the idea to re-record this music. It was time, you know, it was in the middle of the 80s. They wanted to bring out this music from the Weimar Republic again, re-record it. It hadn't been redone since the 50s with Lord Alenia and the Dietrich recordings. And I was the front person for this project. So they chose this young German to do it. And at the same time, I was already in the theater area performing in Paris, and I was already an actress, pretty much known in Europe, performing various plays and musicals. And so that became very, very popular. Like my son, who is studying musicology, says, oh, all my professors grew up with your music. And in the late 80s, this was the album that broke the stigma of the German language, because German language was not loved at all because of the Nazis. So it 80% was German on this record. And it was 50 weeks in the charts here in America. In the crossover charts that exist, I don't think it exists. But then I had also the theater stuff, the movie stuff at the same time. And every time I reached out in a more popular field, like Broadway in Chicago or the West End in London, I liked it, but it was a little unsatisfying at the heart to me.
Right? How so?
I felt the characters were stereotype. I had to fit into the production. I had to do what the directors tell me, and these the clone productions. You know, even though I was the first one creating the part in the London production, I still felt this is not as deep and as free as I want to be on stage.
Interesting.
So, well, I mean, there were certain parts like Sally Bolton Cabaret. It's a great part.
Fantastic.
I love
that.
Yeah, yeah. I played that in the 80s in Paris, and I really thought that was a wonderful part with all the edges to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm most comfortable really in my own shows.
Well, you're also, on top of being a performer and a musician and singer, actress, you're really a researcher and interpreter and a historian in a way, and putting together, mm-hmm. you know, you've taken the works of, you know,
Paulo Coelho.
Coelho.
Yeah.
Which it sounds amazing. Nine Secrets was which sounds incredible. And Bukowski and Neruda and all of these different thinkers and writers and create a show around that. And so that's a very different art than you know.
Yeah, I'm crazy enough to do that because it's a completely uncommercial project.
But you're the real artist for that reason.
Well, I just have that obsession, and then and I just let it go. You know, my intuition starts, and then it's like this motor just goes, and I don't censor it. I just let it go, and then out of the nothing, really, out of a white canvas, comes weeks and weeks later a project.
Have you found a pattern in your life of what leads you to a certain work?
Yeah, everything comes out of... it's all an evolution. It comes out of the previous experience. Like I did Astor Piazzolla music, the tango music with the six musicians from Buenos Aires. We did a world tour with his songs, and then I thought, this is wonderful, but I want to create something new in that Latino American feel of music between tango and Chilean and Brazilian music. And I worked with my bandoneonist from Buenos Aires, and I thought, let's do the love poems of Pablo Neruda and create new music. Besides, I had a great friendship with him, so we had a good time doing it. And it was it just became this project that was captivating me. Neruda was a political person and stood against fascism, and means a lot to the European people, especially in Spain and Italy, where fascism was still so apparent in the last century. And then Bukowski was before, because I always thought there was a Brecht relation between Bukowski and Brecht, and the completely wildness and crudity of rudeness of his writings. I liked it, and there was a political edge in that too, that reminded me of the other people I interpreted. The Nine Secrets of Paulo Coelho, you know, the book The Alchemist is such a great book, and I always kept my love for his books with me. And then I was in a time where I was a bit you know, between the kids and the career, everything went, you know, my husband on my nerves, and it was all like back and forth. I did not know where to go. And I read this book, Manuscripts from Accra, and it was like a Bible without the religion. It really set certain things straight in life. He just spelled out what I felt, but I hadn't spelled it out properly. And then I said, I'm going to make a music project out of this. And I suddenly met him through a friend, a Brazilian journalist. And we had a meeting in Geneva, and he encouraged me, said, do it, you must do it. And then I had to do it. So then I had the pressure from him, and as he's alive and well and follows every footstep.
Even more, I mean, that's exciting in a whole different way.
Yeah. So that was a wonderful thing. And then the previous project, Songs for Eternity, with the songs from the ghettos and concentration camps, that came out of the year 2015, when it was 70-year anniversary commemoration of the Holocaust. I met a specific kind of people in Rome at a big commemoration concert who were researchers for this music, and we just got together and said we have to do it. And I wanted to show the other side of the story, singing, on the other hand, the music from the immigrants that made it out to America.
Mm-hmm.
And this time the ones, the contemporaries who were stuck, who didn't believe they would get killed, and kept writing music in Europe until their death.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Can I ask, you left Germany early on, but what did you still carry with you of German history and Holocaust and your personal relationship with all of that?
Well, everything, you know, yeah. It defines me as an artist, the outrage and the grief and the pain about that, to live with that, you know. As it, to be German, ugh, I just used to hate to say that. You know, people say, oh, Germany is a fantastic country and we make great products and everything runs well. But there's also a cloud over this identity that for me as a young person was really hard to swallow. Not in the context that many times you would meet outside like a Jewish person and that person didn't want to talk to you because you were German, but because reading through it, I just felt my personal confrontation was so much more heartbreaking and deeper than what my parents had given me or my neighbors or my generation even. You know, where was the real personal grief about it? And then I started to intertwine with my art projects and inspire the projects through this grief. And that was very important with the Kurt Weill story, of course. Went along chronologically from the experiences in Germany, his music being burned, being denounced and accused and all of that. And then his grief, leaving his home country and redefining himself later on in France and America and many other contemporaries to him with the same story. And then for some reason, I always, you know, I'm not religious, but I always have lived with Jewish guys, you know, my first, second, third husband, whatever, how many I have. And so I have like, I inherited this heritage through my life because we do celebrate the Jewish holidays. And but I don't like any religion, but I have a lot of respect for it. And more
and for tradition.
Well,
sometimes celebrating the holidays can be more about tradition than religion.
Well, for me, it's really just about a celebration and, yeah, and exactly. to celebrate the family.
Right.
But because the traditions are also questionable, a lot of them are questionable, and they're built on old suspicions and judgments and strange stories. The biblical stories, I'm not sure about those biblical stories.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, right. We could get into Jewish tradition.
No, but all of them, no matter what what tradition, you know,
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and a lot of habits are established in life that are kind of empty and are not necessarily necessary. And then it's just the teaching of it to the children. It's I find it always some kind of brainwashing. You just make them follow rules because they're written in stone in the books for centuries. But why, you know, let if later on they want to follow it out of an adulthood, then they can. But But it's I find it always questionable to put the children into a system of thinking.
But it's a people. I mean, I think the reason why you're able to connect so deeply with the past and the tragedy of the Holocaust and all that it was a people. That's what the Jewish thing is more about than the actual, you know, observance.
Of course, I mean they were regarded as a race at the time. You know, that was the problem. And it's a religion should be a dedication. It's a dedication to a certain way of life and building
it's
of trust
family.
and a certain interpretation of humanity. And but it should never include alienating others.
Right. I mean, that's the thing about any religion that gets me the most is that I'm torn because I respect everyone's beliefs, but if you believe in something absolutely, you're kind of inherently stating that someone else's belief is wrong. Like, I get really stuck on that sometimes.
Yeah, that is a complicated concept.
Yeah, very complicated.
Right.
What was your relationship with your family when you left Germany?
You know, we had many taboos.
Yeah.
A lot of things were not talked about. Uh-huh. There were children in the war, so there was nothing to accuse or dig into because they were kids. They were brought out to the farmlands, you know, when the cities were bombed.
Mm-hmm. Were they pleased with the direction you were going musically?
Well, I'm the one definitely who started making them more conscious about what we have inherited. They kind of like ran away from it in a certain way. And refused to the deep confrontation with it. So I continued doing this, and by like just about 2 weeks ago, there was Schindler's List was again in the TV, and at some point, the guy telling the officer his name at the arrival in Auschwitz said the name Michael Lemper, and I said, did I hear that well? You know. Yeah. And then I researched in the Holocaust surviving a map, and there were like hundreds of Lempers that were. So, and I sent it to my parents because we don't know, you know, when did somebody decide to be Catholic or the roots are so broad in Europe. And I sent it to my parents, and they didn't react to it. I said, you know, look, Dad, you know, I mean, you don't know where we come from and what the storylines are of tribes and people and family trees.
Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting. I always thought there was some, you know, kind of...
A secret Jew.
A secret Jew.
Yeah.
There is not a secret Jew in me. There's a big Jew in me. And I'm very proud of it. No, but everything I stand for and I speak for, I definitely have a very much a love for that. And that comes... Probably out of my heritage.
Absolutely.
That I have. I want to do it. You know, I have the obligation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us this Dietrich story.
Yeah.
Well, that is also, it's 30 years ago, 1988. I lived in Paris. I just had finished cabaret. And I was 24. And
was Paris your first move when you left?
No, Vienna was first.
Vienna was
Austria,
first, okay.
And then there was Berlin in the 80s. Studied in Vienna.
Okay.
Then I went back to Berlin at the height of the Cold War, and then I went to Paris.
Okay.
But I already was touring pretty much. My first time in New York was 86, I think.
Wow.
And I got like the French Tony Award, the Molière Award for being Sally Bowles. And everyone said, oh my God, the new Marlene Dietrich. What are they talking about? this lady of legacy, of this glamorous Hollywood star. How could they say it? She was alive. She lived in Paris, Avenue de Montaigne. She was a recluse. She didn't go out, but she was aware of everything that was going on in the theater world and movie world. And I sent her a letter apologizing for these ridiculous comparisons. And
the humility that you had at that age
what
is astounding.
You to do
yeah, I just did because I know that her five confidants were like fabulous gay dressers and makeup artists in the theater scene. So she had a very few confidants, young guys who were helping her out with the household. And one of them I knew, and he said, you know, why don't you just write her a letter? If you just write on the postcard, Marlene Dietrich, Avenue de Montaigne, Paris, it will arrive, you know?
So funny.
And the letter arrived. It was a little bit of a longer letter, also getting into the German history and
wow.
how much I feel, you know, that she, I wanted to thank her for the inspiration that she also gave to women with her kind of masculine image of being the boss and taking care of things, you know, besides being a sexy lady, you know.
Right. She also did a lot after the war, didn't she? Like, she took in immigrants, and I think
she was an American soldier in the war. She was an expatriate. She never went back to Germany after the Blue Angel, after 1930. She joined the American Army. She sang for the American soldiers. She was at the front lines.
She was an entertainer.
As an entertainer, yeah. But encouraging the soldiers
and keeping
their morals up
.
All the way until the end. For 3 years, she was in the trenches with them. She wore uniform.
Wow.
And that was her issues. So let me first go back.
Yeah.
She then contacted me after receiving the letter and thanking me and saying, my God, how nice and wise your letter is and how old are you? And we spoke for 3 hours on the telephone.
Oh, my God.
She called me and we spoke for literally 3 hours. And that's where she told me her life story. Not like in an interview form, but she just was scattered with her thoughts.
How old was she then?
She was 88.
I want to make a comparison to what that would be like today for like a young actress who's like, you know, all of a sudden becomes compared to
Marilyn Monroe, and she would be still
and then you get to call and speak on the phone.
Yeah, that And I was young. For me, it was, I didn't internalize it as much as I did through the course of the following 30 years until today. Yeah. So, yes, we went very much into the German history. So what happened with her was while she was making movies in Hollywood and then the war came and she kept doing her, she was with everyone. And she also with every man, leading man, she had them all from Jimmy Stewart to Gary Cooper to John Wayne to Orson Welles to Yul Brynner and Hemingway and the whole list of people, hundreds of them, you know. She was girls too. She was with Edith Piaf. She just thought, whoever is attractive, I want to make love to.
Yeah.
That's what she said. It's kind of a very cool concept, right?
Yeah.
And
especially when was that?
That was in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s. And when then she, you know, got a little older and I guess a little tired.
Pulled her heels a little bit, yeah.
But she was also still with Kennedy, by the way, John F. Kennedy. She was 20 years older than he was in those years, in the 60s.
Kennedy's another one who got around to
Or 50s, 60s.
So it makes sense they would have got around with each other at some point.
Right. And but anyway, so we spoke about Germany, and she went back in the 1960s. First, she did a movie with Billy Wilder in Berlin, A Foreign Affair, in the destroyed Berlin, which is an incredible movie with scenery of the real Berlin, completely bombed out.
I don't think I know that film.
And she spoke about, you know, that she couldn't believe that was her Berlin from the Weimar time. There was nothing left but walls broken down and the women who, you know, helped picking up the pieces. And that was only a year after the war that they shot the movie in Berlin. And then she went back in the 60s to sing, you know, when she started her world chanteuse career, and Burt Bacharach was her arranger, her musical director, her pianist. He was with her for 15 years, performing everywhere. So she went back to Berlin. And she was booed. The people were with signs outside the theaters. Marlene, go home. Traitor. She had sung for the, she had fought for the enemy. You know, that's what the Germans still thought. It was 1960, 15 years after the war. And they threw stink bombs at her, and there were bomb threats at the theaters. They did not know. They were so entrapped into the history being Nazis and marching for the Nazis and finding everyone who was against as a traitor, that still 15 years after, they did not know. So they showed her hatred.
Wow.
And she was so broken. And she said, the Germans and I no longer speak the same language. Yeah. And she did not go back there. Only once for UNICEF and another peace gala, international corporations and stuff, but never anything again, just purely German. Mm-hmm. And she said she cried many tears about it, and she had to give up her country, basically the way the Jews had in the 20s. You know what Kurt Weill said: don't speak to me in German ever anymore, and I'm not Kurt, I'm Kurt now. No, I'm not. Everything had to go away from that painful past, being denounced and discriminated and assaulted in your own country.
Did she also have anti-Semitic views at the same time as wanting to fight for
No. Okay. All her collaborators were Jewish anyway. Yeah. You know, von Sternberg, who did the Blue Angel, and Friedrich Holländer, who did her main music, and all Billy Wilder, and the Hollywood was made out of immigrants from Europe, and a lot of them were Jewish, and these were her best friends. She was horrified. Then she also said being a soldier, she did not know really what happened in the concentration camps, but later on when she heard, she was shivering and she couldn't not believe what the Germans had done. And she said also that she was scared of capture. When she was in the front lines with the soldiers, she was afraid to be captured by the Germans. You know, what would they have done to an expatriate fighting for the enemy? They would have thrown her in the concentration camp too.
Yeah.
No, she definitely had. And she was asked many times after the Blue Angel come back to Germany to do more German movies. But then that was in the 30s when the Nazis were already in power. And she said, there was no way I wanted to go back to the Hitler nation and with Leni Riefenstahl and do movies for the Germans. No way she wanted to go back. Yeah, they wanted to have her back, of course.
So
she was clear with her political allegiance.
Right.
So then how did that call impact you going forward then and to now?
Well, a lot... lots of things. I mean, people always said, you know, because I haven't lived in, you know, more important, 1992, we go 4 years later when she died. 4 years later.
Did you ever meet her in person? Never, or just never, the phone call?
No, just the phone call. And I was in Berlin at that time performing, rehearsing the play, The Blue Angel, Marlena's play, The Blue Angel. I was Lola, her part. 10 days before the opening night, she passed away. She had a glorious funeral in Paris in the Église de la Madeleine. Thousands of people came. And then her last wish was to be buried in Berlin at the cemetery with her mother, where she was, you know, born. And so she was then brought to Berlin in the coffin. And 6 days before opening night, I was at the funeral, laid a rose on her grave, and then I was Lola. And that was a haunted production. Wow. People still didn't want The Blue Angel back. We were slammed by the reviews. It was a horrible thing. People didn't know what to do. The Berliners wanted to give a street name, Marlene Dietrich, to the street where she was born. And the people in the street were protesting. It was 1992 now. Don't call our street Marlene Dietrichstraße. Wow. And only later, after 2000, they called a big place, a space next to Potsdamer Platz, Marlene Dietrich Platz, you know, a square. Mm-hmm. Finally, they had accepted it. And 2001 was the big 100-year anniversary for Marlene. And I was again, you know, the main artist in that show singing her songs. By that time now, they had celebrated her. She was now back a symbol, a status symbol for Berlin. But look, it took them how many years it took them. So that's for me where the story finalizes, you know. First of all, with my Blue Angel in Berlin, her passing away, her funeral. And then finally in 2001, again, Friedrichstadtpalast, Berlin, a united Berlin at the time, a different kind of Germany. Finally, they celebrated her. So things grew over time. And then last year, I got three offers. Paris to play Marlene Dietrich in a play with Jean Gabin. Jean Gabin was one of her main lovers and love affairs of her life, a crazy relationship, fantastic play. But I would have to move to Paris. I said, I can't do it. I have my life is here. Another thing in Montreal to play a play Marlene Dietrich and Edith Piaf. It's a play with the both of them. Interesting, but I didn't like the way the part was written out for Marlene. It was a very stereotype and not at all.
Didn't feel true.
Yeah, no. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I said, I'm just going to have to write my own thing.
Great.
Forget it. So that's what I did. And that I did through the research with the confrontation with these plays. And that's what I did.
So here we go. Good. That's good. Oh, that's such a good lesson. Yes. Yeah. Ladies, if you're offered parts that don't feel right, write your own.
Yes. Write your own.
Yeah. Easier said than done. Yeah. But if you have the opportunity, do it. Yeah.
Well, and if there is some special relationship with the part, you know, in my case, there is a special relationship. Yeah. And I have such an overview of her life and now 30 years later of my life that has somehow led me in very similar directions with living abroad, falling in love with America and the international culture and being an international artist. So at this point, there are many, many relationships. With her, and yet some really personal secrets she told me over the phone that finally I feel ready now to share, including her affinity for the poet Rilke, Rainer Maria Rilke. He's like, I would say he's the one that inspired Coelho probably in many, many philosophical ways. Very beautiful quotes she gave me over the phone. And I'm looking forward to bring it all out and tell the story and sing the songs.
So part of it will be spoken? Is that how?
Yeah, lots of spoken. And I'm figuring it out right now. I'm slipping into her persona and then back into my nonstop. So it's really, I don't want to sing the songs either with her persona too much because my musicality is very different from hers and her diction was very specific and she spoke about the way she had sketched out her way of interpretation and laying on the consonants, finishing the words and
deliberate about that. That's
She was deliberate about it. And so I'm skipping back between her and myself nonstop. It's like in the Seven Deadly Sins, Anna 1 and Anna 2, I'm her and myself. But I still tell the stories from the me story. I skip definitely into her persona and tell it with her kind of voice. But I go back and forth asking questions. Within the song or within the dialogue, asking questions that are truly asked to her. and then I'm back and forth. So it's a bit of a it's a bit of an ego trip. I mean, like a conflictual ego, a Freudian, over ego, under ego,
exactly,
and a culmination of your life experience. In, like,
yes,
this
by now,
very
definitely.
Way.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Awesome. So that's gonna be at the Cafe Carlisle,
our favorite place.
February 27th through March 3rd.
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's only the beginning. So that's for me like a really...
I was going
to
ask.
I'm trying to... I already have lots of people, bookings in the world.
Oh, fantastic.
That is an interesting... I think it should be eventually a play. You know,
it
should be an
like
off-Broadway
like play.
But I'm just trying to get it under my nails and into my mouth and into my soul. And
and the Carlisle such check, a yeah, wonderful
it's
place
a, it's
that.
A neighborhood place. I performed there 10 years ago. And
that's right. You have an album from that, right?
Yes, a live album. But I usually am kind of more like a downtown girl when it gets to performing in the clubs.
Like where?
Joe's Pub.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I used to be in the Bottom Line when it was still there, and you know, CBGBs and so and so, but or the jazz clubs. But this one is really very much. It has Carlisle has this old heritage of New York. There is something beautiful about the reputation that is for decades and decades the Carlisle. So I think this show really fits well into the Carlisle, and so.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's try.
even the young people in that room at the Carlisle feel like old souls. Yes. You know,
there's and the room with the frescoes on the walls.
Exactly.
It's so beautiful. Yeah, it has an old Berlin
world,
feel
old
to it. Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Well, we can't wait to see it,
and can't wait
to see what comes after that and where that takes you.
Mm-hmm.
Probably
yeah.
back all around the world.
It's a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
thank
being
you
on the
very
show.
Much for having me.
Come on, babe, I don't repaint the town. I know that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. I know that jazz, start the car. I know a whoopee spot where the gin is cold but the piano's hot. It's just a noisy hall where there's a nightly brawl and all. But jazz.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.